last talk. That is, to blame the burning of Servetus on Calvin is utterly ridiculous, because Calvin opposed his being burned. He definitely opposed it. Calvin favored his execution, but he opposed his being burned. And Calvin was not the judge. Calvin did not have any official position in connection with it, and all of the Protestant leaders of the time expressed their agreement that Servetus should have been condemned and executed. The council at Geneva corresponded with all the prominent leaders of the time, Protestant leaders, and not one expressed any strong dissent to what they had done. So we finished looking at considerations relating to Calvin's personal relation to this. But there were a couple of more points I thought we should look at under this connection on the general question. And we should not take much time on general questions like this in this class, because we are interested in seeing the history of the Christian church, what has happened, how it happened, noticing what lessons we can get for ourselves in these days from the way God has worked in his church in the past, and also the way that Satan has worked and the successes he has had. But we take a little time occasionally when there is a vital point, even though long discussion should go either in apologetics or systematic theology or some other section rather than church history. And so I mentioned at the end of the hour these three considerations, I guess it's four, which deal with the general matter. I didn't want to start until we would have time to go into them a little bit. And so I just barely mentioned our first of them at the end of the hour. F, I called it, the present widespread idea that the preservation of human life, even that of a murderer, is more important than anything else, has no scriptural or reasonable basis. Humanity tends to go from one extreme to the other. I remember hearing when I was in seminary, a missionary who had been active in India was back and speaking to us, and he remarked on the contrasts in India as it was at that time, for more than 40 years ago. The remarkable contrast. He said he had been up on the Afghanistan border, where many people were constantly fighting and were considered human life so cheap that they would shoot at almost anything. Even the young boys there were shooting down anybody who they saw near the border. And then he said, in some parts of South India, there were people who considered all life so sacred that they would have a servant go in front of them with a broom, sweeping the path, lest they should step on a little insect, and thus should commit the terrible sin of destroying life. Well, I think that presents the two opposite extremes of the attitude toward life. And neither of them is either biblical or reasonable. Now, in pagan societies, and in all history, in fact, except insofar as that has been affected by Christianity, the general attitude has been to consider a human life rather cheaply. I remember hearing a story told of a missionary 50 years ago in China, seeing a Chinese boy who had fallen from a boat. And the missionary dived in. According to the story I heard, he dived in and he saved the boy from drowning and brought him up and brought him back to the people on the boat. And he said, you saved him. It's up to you now to take care of him the rest of his life. We have no further responsibility for him. Now, that, of course, was an attitude in that particular part of China at that time, but it is true of most non-Christian societies that human life is rated very cheap. In ancient Rome, before Christianity made changes, right up to the time when Christianity tremendously affected Roman society, it was customary with babies that were unwanted simply to expose them, as they said, to put them out in the hills and just leave them to die. It was common practice among the pagans at that time, and no one seems to have been much affronted by it or to have had much thought of it being wrong. Now, the Christianity teaches that God has created man and God has given him a soul, and human life has a sacredness about it, which is something that most pagan religions have no idea of at all. But in recent years, this has been carried to an extreme which goes way beyond any biblical teaching. And we've even heard in recent years people say, suppose a man has killed someone else, has murdered someone, he's committed a great wrong. Does that mean the state should commit a great wrong and kill him? And that's an argument used against capital punishment. And most of our states have now given up capital punishment. But the Bible definitely commands capital punishment in certain cases. And in the Old Testament, capital punishment was a very definite part of God's law and God's command. And the idea, we find it in medicine. We have cases now where a person will be in suffering, so injured that they cannot possibly recover, and in terrible suffering, and some will think that it is the duty of doctors to keep their body breathing just as long as they possibly can, to keep the breath in the body as long as possible. I don't see how any true Christian can have any real sympathy with that idea. If there's no hope of a person recovering a reasonably happy place in life, is it not far better for a Christian to go and be with the Lord than to be just everything possible done to keep him breathing and suffering just as long as you can? It's an attitude which has developed, and this is true in the history of thought, that on all sorts of things, ideas go to one extreme and go to the other extreme. And ideas sort of permeate society. And I think it would be very foolish for any of you to think it was your duty to go out and devote your life to changing people's attitudes on some of these things. They are comparatively minor. But I think it's vital we have a correct understanding and we don't allow ourselves to be instruments in advancing extreme ideas one direction or the other where they are not biblical. Yes, Mr. Warren?
Yes, Dr. J. I'm screwing up your theology. Well, I'm
what I'm saying is that if it's a mere question of existence, yes, existence and suffering, there is no biblical command that we should expend every possible effort to keep a person breathing a little longer. But it's an attitude today that's widespread. Now, as far as the doctor is concerned, it may be a necessary attitude because we don't want to give doctors the power of determining, well, this one's worth keeping alive and this one we'll let die. That should not be the doctor's right to determine. But as far as a family is concerned, if a person is in suffering and there's no hope absolutely of their recovering, for the family to spend great sums of money hiring a doctor to keep them breathing just a little bit longer is fitting with an attitude that's widespread today. And all I'm saying is this attitude is in the air today. It's part of our present civilization, but it is not a biblical teaching. It's not particularly reasonable, and it is comparatively recent. It's an attitude which was not held among any large number of people to any great extent until quite recently. But now it is very, very widespread. And of course, it's one reason why we have so many murders and why we have so much crime is that the person has no reason to think he'll suffer greatly if he is implicated in crime now. But that's not the Bible teaching. The biblical teaching is that crime should be punished and as far as possible stopped. But this is a wicked world where we cannot expect perfection. But all we can do is to do the best we can in the wicked world, and the best we can possibly do is to win people to the Lord. And I would say that, of course, if a person's living longer means they'll have an opportunity to hear the gospel and be saved, then, of course, it's worth it a great deal to try to keep them living a little longer for that purpose. But aside from that, if a person is lost, there's no great advantage to them or to the world in simply permitting them to live a little longer in wickedness to store up more retribution for themselves in the future, and certainly not to the Christian to live a little longer in suffering and have, instead of going to be with the Lord, which, as Paul says, is far better. So that the tendency today, naturally, is to think, well, here a man was killed. That's the most terrible crime there could be. Calvin's connected with it, therefore Calvin was wicked. But that, of course, is not logical or reasonable. And I'm merely pointing out that this attitude toward human life today, while far better than the opposite extreme, typical of pagans, far better than that, is not a biblical teaching and is not required either by the Bible or by reason. Then G, small g, destruction of human souls is far worse than destruction of physical bodies. Destruction of human souls is far worse than destruction of physical bodies. And of course, the attitude of all governments in the Middle Ages and until quite recently, the attitude of all governments was that murderers should be executed, that those who destroy physical bodies should have capital punishment. Well, when people really believed that those whose faith was destroyed and who were denied the opportunity of hearing the gospel would suffer through all eternity, when they really believed that, it certainly was far worse to be spreading that which would destroy human faith than it would be to be spreading disease germs that would hurt the body. That was a natural, logical attitude which was held by all people in those days. It's so contrary to the usual attitude today that it's rather hard for a person to put himself back into it. But it is to quite an extent assumed in the Old Testament, where in the Lord's endeavor to raise up Israel as a people through which his name would be kept alive in the midst of a world that had turned its way, it turned away from God, God smote with leprosy, or he even struck dead those who broke his holy law on certain cases, and for certain crimes against the truth of God, for those who disseminated attacks upon the truth of God, it is ordered in the Pentateuch that they should be put to death. And so this point, I think, is again something that would be foolish for us to try to make a great deal of in our day. We can't affect these things a great deal, but it's good for us to have serious thinking on it, on how terrible is the destruction of human souls. And therefore, it's easy to see that, you take the pilgrims in New England. And when they became established there, and they were trying, they had gone through terrible difficulties and struggles in order to establish a place where they could bring up their children in the knowledge of the Bible and not have the constant influences which they'd had in England and in Holland, leading their children away from the training they wanted them to have. And then when they found that among the new group that came to join them, there were two or three who were trying to tear down the influence they were trying to have in their children, they simply packed them up and put them on a boat and shipped them back to England. They did not allow them to continue to do that in their group where they were trying to develop a truly Christian community. Well, this is G, then let's mention H. A small h, the idea of almost complete freedom of speech. The idea of almost complete freedom of speech that has developed during the last three centuries. The idea of almost complete freedom of speech that has developed during the last three centuries is a comparatively recent development. Unknown in Reformation times, and seldom thought of in any previous period. Is a comparatively recent development, unknown in Reformation times, and seldom thought of in any previous period. Now, there are some in the Supreme Court today, not the majority by any means, but there are some there who hold that there should be absolute freedom of expression to say or to print any words or ideas that anyone feels inclined to at any time. That is not the view held by the majority of American people or by the majority of the Supreme Court. It is held that there are things that can be said that will cause tremendous injury and that should not be. According to our laws, the post office is not supposed to carry pornographic literature, particularly when addressed to minors. And there are those who think that some are making a deliberate effort to undermine the moral character of our youth by sending licentious literature in plain wrappers through the mail that affects young minds. We feel that it is perfectly right to try to prevent it. There are very few who believe that absolute freedom of speech is desirable or practical. In Russia, you go to the absolutely opposite extreme. If you say something in Russia that even slightly suggests the possibility that the communist government is not the most perfect type of thing the world has ever seen, you may land in hard labor for 10 years. The punishment is very, very severe for saying anything that the communist officials think will undermine their power in the slightest. We have both extremes in the world on this point. But in our Western world, the idea has gone very, very far that one should be free to say almost anything that he wants to. I'm not at this point trying to argue what is right and wrong on it, but merely to say that in judging Reformation Day, we should not assume that the attitude was held then that is so widely held now, that one should be almost completely free in whatever he wants to say. And those are really the three points there that I think are important in relation to this matter, in general relation. But there is a fourth one that I think should be noted. That's a small j further about this idea of almost complete freedom of speech. Small j, this idea has great advantages. This idea has great advantages and also great dangers. This idea has great advantages and also great dangers. It is bound to lead to disaster, comma, if the corresponding. This idea has great advantages and also great dangers, period. It is bound to lead to disaster, comma, if the corresponding responsibility of using this freedom in such a way as to combat harmful ideas is not fully exercised. If the corresponding responsibility of using this freedom in such a way as to combat harmful ideas is not fully exercised. As far as we are concerned, theoretically, you might say that a very considerable curtailment of the breadth of freedom of speech that we have would be desirable, you might say, but you can't have a great deal of effect upon it. But if we do have it, certainly we have a tremendous responsibility. There are small groups of people who are using their freedom of speech in a very active way in ways which will inevitably, eventually, completely destroy it and do away with the whole of life as we know it now. And if we do not move against those people by cutting down or interfering with their freedom of speech, and I'm certainly not saying we should, then certainly it's our responsibility to speak up and to present what we believe. And it really is amazing. I was very much struck with Mr. Nixon's testimony the other night, how he spoke a word against this man's profanity and how what an effect it had far beyond what he expected. I've been amazed several times to notice, to be with a group where everybody seems to be talking in one direction, and you feel so much alone and out of it, you feel like just saying nothing. And yet, every now and then, if you speak up, and speak up clearly and strongly, you'll find that half the group agree with you. Very often. Half the group agree with you, and they may speak up too. And you may find that the one or two loud talkers who seem to carry everyone along with them were absolutely not representative at all. But since most of us tend to keep quiet and not to speak our ideas out a great deal, and if other people are loud and boisterous on them, to simply silently regret it, since most people are that way, it's comparatively easy for small groups to mold the thinking of great groups by simply speaking strongly, and people are just carried along without thinking. I've been with very highly intelligent people. I've been amazed occasionally in recent years. Highly intelligent people who agreed with me on most things. I've heard them saying something along certain lines that I didn't like, that I disliked so much, my tendency was just to keep quiet. But I've spoken up against it. And to my amazement, they've pretty soon been talking just as strongly on the other side. And I think most people have a tendency on a great many of their ideas simply to take them over uncritically and then to repeat them thoughtlessly. But it's a great effort, and it takes a great deal of work to really make your ideas felt on all subjects. And until recently, those who felt strongly felt, as the communists do today, that the best way to handle them is to forbid. It's interesting to note these radicals today who want freedom of speech and great demonstrations and all that, and then when someone comes to their institution and speaks on the other side, how often they will yell and make disturbances and not allow him to have a hearing at all. It shows how often it's merely a front when people talk about freedom of speech. They mean freedom of speech for their own particular view. Well, our attitude, the attitude today in our country is you shouldn't interfere with free expression of ideas. As long as we have that attitude, we should be sure to express our ideas also. But people did not have that attitude in the past. And in connection with Servetus, you had a man who was not simply believing certain things that were different from what the others believed, but a man who was writing letters and printing material and distributing things to try in every possible way to tear down belief in the Trinity. And the attitude of the Protestant leaders was, the Romanists say that we are anarchists and nihilists. They are completely wrong. We believe in true Christianity. Now the Romanists will seem in the eyes of the world to be right if we allow a man who is attacking the very basis of common Christianity, such as both they and we hold, the common central teachings of Christianity, if we allow a man who is so determined to destroy this as he is to go on without checking him and stopping him altogether when we have an opportunity. So while the burning of Servetus was something that appears very contrary to the attitudes of our Western world today, though comparatively mild to the attitude of the communists in a third of the world today, yet it is not properly a ground for judging Reformation leaders, since the general attitude of the world is so different than it is now. And it certainly is not a proper ground for attack upon Keller. Now let's go on to number four, Roman numeral four. Roman numeral four will be other developments on the continent of Europe in the 16th century. Other developments on the continent of Europe in the 16th century. It is difficult to know how to arrange this material because we are looking at great vital events which affected millions of people then and ever since. And you cannot understand most of these movements unless you trace them through a way. And yet each of them is affected by others. And therefore we took Luther and went through, and we took Calvin and went through, and the two overlapped to a great extent. Now the there are two other main movements we want to look at, one of which is a sort of combination movement in Great Britain. That will be Roman number 5. We're not to that yet. But that affects us more directly than most of the continental developments. But the other movement that has affected great multitudes of people that we're going to look at first, we're principally going to look at, is the so-called Counter-Reformation. I'm not making that the title here, because there are one or two movements that did not affect such large numbers of people, which should be noticed at that same time. And I'm putting them under this head. But the Counter-Reformation was a movement which succeeded in winning back fully a third of the territory that Protestantism had taken over. And taking a territory in which 9/10 of the people probably were Protestants at, say, 1550, and so changing it within a few years that for the succeeding 300 years, there was hardly a person there who ever had the chance to hear the gospel of salvation by faith. And so millions of people were affected by this Counter-Reformation. And in a way, it would seem logical to discuss the Reformation in England before we take up the Counter-Reformation, quite a different type of movement. And yet, the Counter-Reformation affects all of these so much. And the English movement was a little later than the other two. It seems better to put it in between. But before we get to the Counter-Reformation, I want to speak of one or two other movements on the continent of Europe at that time. And so capital A here will be the origin of the Mennonites. The origin of the Mennonites. M-E-N-N-O-N-I-T-E-S. Now the reason I'm calling this section Origin of the Mennonites is because movements that we will look at under this area mostly have left no trace in the present day, except for this one, the Mennonites. And while the Mennonites are not one of our largest groups by any means, they are a group which has a very considerable number of people in it, and which has definitely survived from the latter part of the 16th century to the present. So under A, we say, number one, the Anabaptists. The Anabaptists, capital A-N-A-B-A-P-T-I-S-T-S. The Anabaptists. Number one, the Anabaptists. And we should not confuse the Anabaptists of the 16th century with the Baptists of today. The Baptists of today are not a continuation of the Anabaptists. They have been indirectly affected by them, but not directly. The Mennonites are a direct continuation of a portion of the Anabaptists of the 16th century. The Baptists of today find their origin in the next century, in the 17th century. These Anabaptists, I'll make a subhead, small a under that, general nature of the groups. These people did not call themselves Anabaptists. They had many different names for different groups. But they came to be classed together in histories under this title, Anabaptists. They were people, mostly poor people, a few educated people among them. But great numbers of poor people in various parts of Europe, starting particularly in Switzerland and in Holland, and also to quite an extent in Germany, and some in other countries. But the groups were many different types of groups. The invention of printing, the greater increase in literacy, more people began thinking for themselves, more people began reading, and many individuals began gathering people around them with different kinds of teaching. And so the Anabaptists, the name was given by their opponents. And the reason for the name was that these very different types of groups felt differently from Luther and Calvin in their relation to the church through the ages. The attitude of Luther and Calvin was that the Christian church, that is the church invisible, made up of all the redeemed, has continued through the ages, And Luther and Calvin both felt there had been great saints in the Middle Ages who perhaps didn't understand salvation by faith as fully as we do. Didn't express it as clearly, but many of whom had the idea very definitely in mind. And Luther reprinted many of their works. And they felt that they were continuing the Christian movement. But these different groups took the attitude that the truth has been unknown and we have now discovered it. And consequently, they wanted to make a complete break with the background. And they symbolized this break by pouring water over each other's heads. And this was so widely done that others, some called them Catabaptists, but more came to call them Anabaptists, that is, baptizing again. And so this was a general term for these groups, which sprang up in many sections of Europe. Now I have here the church history by Newman, a Baptist professor, who, though he recognizes that the Baptists are not directly descended from the Anabaptists, yet he takes perhaps a greater interest in them than most church histories do. And so it's very interesting to note his fuller account than we find in most histories. And here he has a section he calls the Anti-Pedobaptist Reformation, he calls it. And under it he has 12 pages on what he calls the Chiliastic Anabaptists. And then he has 13 what he calls the Biblical Anabaptists. And then he has 13 on what he calls the Mystical Anabaptists. And then a group that he calls the Pantheistic Anabaptists, and then a group he calls the Anti-Trinitarian Anabaptists. And I think that gives a good idea of what a variety there was of beliefs among these different people. Now, Newman in here is particularly lights among these, among the group he calls the Biblical Anabaptists, one named Balthazar Hubmaier. Hubmaier. He calls him a learned and eloquent priest who was in Switzerland, and who he describes his views on many things, and he says he was almost Hubmaier was almost alone among contemporary Anabaptists in agreeing with modern Baptists regarding oaths, magistracy, warfare, and the right of Christians to hold private property. Except for the fact that he did not believe in immersion as the act of baptism, his position is hardly distinguishable from that of modern Baptists. And few writers of any age have, with this exception, he says, more ably expounded the distinctive principles of the Baptists. And it's interesting to note how, while they agree with modern Baptists in opposing infant baptism, immersion is practically unknown among the Anabaptists. There may have been a few who practiced it. Hubmaier, Newman says, once baptized 300 people out of a milk pail. I don't see how he could have even poured and gotten that many out of a milk pail. But small be then, the great variety of the Anabaptists. Now number two, the Münster episode. The Münster episode. Capital M-U-N-S-T-E-R. The Münster episode. Now this is an event which had a great effect upon all future history of the Anabaptists. The Münster episode. M-U-N-M-U-E-N, or M-U, if you write in German, there'd be two little dots over the U. N-S-T-E-R. It is a city in western Germany near the French or Dutch border. And in this city, the bishop was a very strong Romanist, but the Anabaptists in Holland, some of them went to this city and began preaching and aroused interest among them there. And managed to gain considerable control in the city, and the bishop was driven out. And then hundreds of other Anabaptists, largely from Holland, went to Münster under the leading of a man named Jan Matthys, who declared that Enoch had appeared in the person of Matthys, that the millennial kingdom was at hand, and that the baptized saints should henceforth, under the dominion of Christ, lead the blessed life with community of goods, without laws, and without magistrates. And within 8 days, 1,400 people were baptized, and the city was taken over by them. Then it soon developed that these people held that the theocratic kingdom should be established with the merciless slaughter of the ungodly. And the Lutherans and Catholics fled from the city. Many people were killed. Many others submitted to baptism. The entire wealth of the city was soon in the hand of the fanatics. And they declared now that Münster was the new Jerusalem. And they sent messengers in all directions to summon followers to hear for further instructions. Thousands from all parts of the Netherlands and adjoining regions were soon moving toward Münster. Many of these were seized by the authorities, but a great multitude reached the New Jerusalem. And the city was soon besieged by the bishop and his allies, but the people very vigorously defended it for some months. Matthys was slain in battle. Another man who was called John in Leiden, John of Leiden, a city in Holland, L-E-Y-D-E-N, took over the leadership and organized the new Israel, appointing 12 elders with power of life and death to sit in judgment twice each day. As the number of women in the city greatly exceeded that of men, polygamy was introduced. It was revealed to John the new Jerusalem should have a king who should have dominion over the whole earth, and that he was that king. And for more than a year, they resisted the siege. In the end, the forces that came against them succeeded in overcoming their opposition, taking the city, and the leaders were, John of Leiden was put in a cage, low enough that he couldn't stand up, not wide enough that he could lie out upright, and it was hung up on the top of one of the big high buildings, and he was left there to die. And the leaders were most cruelly treated by those who had conquered, and many people were massacred through the whole area. But, of course, the great result of it was to give people all over Europe the impression that this was what Anabaptists stood for, this sort of thing. And it was a tremendous setback to the whole Anabaptist movement. And Newman says that in Germany and other continental countries, the odium of Münster still attaches to the Baptist name. Now, he wrote this some years ago. I never heard of any such thing when I was over there. But you can well imagine how such an episode as this would make a great impression on people who knew nothing about it except what they had heard of them. But it resulted in great opposition to Anabaptists in many countries. I was reading that in Switzerland, where there were thousands of Anabaptists at that time, there are only about 2,000 today. Though I believe there's still about 50,000 in Holland. But that's where the great bulk of them are today. But it probably would have meant a complete end to all of these Anabaptist groups, the impression made by this, if it were not for a man who stepped into the situation. This man, we'll call him number three, Menno Simons. Menno Simons. Menno Simons was a Romanist priest in Holland who was converted to the Reformation and who began to take some leadership in Holland. And then he and his associates were horrified by what happened at Münster and reacted to the opposite extreme and took a stand absolutely against any use of force, against all war, and rejected oaths, magistracy, They stood for complete non-resistance. A Men of Simons was a man of considerable ability and great energy who traveled back and forth between Holland and Switzerland and the countries between, gathering together these groups of Anabaptists and preaching to them and presenting to them his teachings, which were the very opposite of the attitude the Anabaptist leaders had taken at Münster. And the result was that he organized them into a group that, with a principle of absolute non-resistance, has continued up to the present day. Menno was not particularly well educated. And while he was very energetic and had a very fine attitude in many ways on the matter of the doctrine of Christ, he was not well trained. And he presented the idea that Christ was not actually born of Mary, but that his human nature was a direct new creation of God. And this, many of his associates did not follow him in. And there's always been certain question among some of the leaders on certain points of this type, but they have not been stressed. They have been, on the whole, a group stressing the great central doctrines of Christianity, and with this principle of non-resistance, they have survived, particularly in Holland, a country where toleration soon developed more than in any other country of Europe. Eventually, there was a large group of them who went from Germany into Russia, and there was a large Mennonite group in South Russia for many years. Some of them came to, I think it was North Dakota or Nebraska, somewhere out that section. There's quite a group of people who I've heard people call the German Russians, and they are people who spoke German but who had lived in Russia for generations and who came over here prior to 1917. There was quite a large Mennonite group in Russia, but it seems to have disappeared during World War II. At least there's been no news of them that I've been able to hear since World War II. But up to that time, up to the Bolshevik takeover, they were quite a strong group in Russia. They still are a considerable group in Holland, and there's maybe 250,000 of them in the United States, largely in a few localities. They are divided into a number of different groups, one of which is the so-called plain people here in the area of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, that don't use automobiles. And among the Mennonites, up till 1900, there was no paid ministry. It's only since that a paid ministry has developed. They used to meet mostly in homes, and the ministers were usually farmers who preached on Sunday and worked in between. They are not a large group, but they are a group which deserves great credit for the way that they have stood through these centuries, and with their principle of non-resistance have suffered greatly for their belief. Unfortunately, they, like all groups in America today of any history, any age, have been affected to some extent by modernism, and some of their groups and some of their colleges have a very considerable entrance of anti-Christian teaching, though there are many of them who are standing very true to the great fundamentals to this day. Now, so much for A, then, the origin of the Mennonites. B is Socinianism. Socinianism. Now, Socinianism is more a movement of thought than a movement of people. It affected various people, but it was a movement of denial of the Trinity. And the denial of the Trinity is often called Socinianism. After two highly educated Italians called Socinus, S-O-C-I-N-U-S. These two men, an uncle and his nephew, gave their name to the view of the denial, the definite denial of the Trinity. And they came from Italy, but their greatest influence was in Poland, although they had followers all over Europe. And it's a movement of thought which was quite different from Mennonite movement, because it definitely denied definite scriptural teaching. And it has been effective at many different places, many times. In Poland, at one time, a third of the people of Poland were Protestant. And we mentioned last week how when Henry III became king of Poland, he was forced, was required to promise he would do nothing against Protestantism. Well, then the Jesuits came into Poland, and they found the Protestants in Poland divided between Lutherans and Calvinists, and then they found the Socinians making great headway in Poland. And the Jesuits, in this situation of disunity in Poland, the Jesuits managed to get one group working against the other and to play it up and to argue with them. The Jesuits were highly trained, and then they managed to get the situation where they were able to introduce persecution, and Protestantism almost completely died out of Poland after a third of the nation having been Protestant. Now, the entrance of Socinianism and the great controversies to which it gave rise had considerable to do with the destruction of Protestantism in Poland. It's a very sad thing, because some of the Polish leaders in the Reformation time were among the most gifted and finest leaders in the Reformation. But in recent years, very few Poles have had the chance to hear the gospel at all. I've heard it said that there's among gangsters and that sort of thing in America that a tremendous number are of Polish extraction. And that is, if so, it is due to the fact of their not having had the chance to hear the gospel as a result of the complete victory of the Counter-Reformation in that land. We'll look at that briefly under the Counter-Reformation. But unfortunately, I think the entrance of Socinianism and also the attitude of the German Lutherans, who write so near to Pope, and yet because they were not following the strict Lutheran views, they didn't take an interest in trying to help them particularly in the situation. I think those two were sad features in the downfall of Protestantism in Poland. In France, we had this great success of Protestantism for a time, later almost completely rooted out, as we saw a century later, and there are many books about it and much literature about it. In Poland, I had to do considerable hunting to find material giving many details on it. One year I took a good bit more time than we'll dare to this year on the Counter-Reformation in Poland. I found it hard to find material on it, which is because it was so nearly completely rooted out and so much more quickly than it happened in France. I think it's one thing we should remember. Church history is wonderful to see how God has worked, but it is equally important, or perhaps not equally, but very important, we also see how the devil has worked, and that we learn not to let ourselves make the mistakes that some people have made at other times, which give the devil opportunity to use the mistakes of good people for the destruction of true Christianity. But now, capital C is the beginnings of the Counter-Reformation. The beginnings of the Counter-Reformation. The really effective thing in the Counter-Reformation was something nobody dreamed of at the time. It was the foundation of the Jesuit order. We're going to make that a separate title later. But first we will look at the foundations of the Counter-Reformation. Number one, attitudes of the contemporary Pope. We've already noticed to quite an extent the attitude of Leo X and Adrian VI and Clement VII. Leo X was 1513 to 21. He was entirely interested in his worldly pleasures and plans for advance of his family, and he was comparatively little interested in the Reformation. He liked to destroy Luther. He tried to, but that was a minor thing in his life. Adrian VI, who followed from January 1522 to September 1523, admitted the church is corrupt in root and branches. We have all sinned. We need to reform ourselves. He said, you destroy Luther and we'll reform the church. And the German diet said, you reform the church first before you start telling us to destroy Luther. But before much could be accomplished, Adrian VI died. And after his death, the people of Rome put up a monument to his position. They were so happy to be freed from him, and never again have they elected a non-Italian to be Pope. Clement VII, who succeeded him, was Pope from 1523 to 1534, and he followed strictly in the lines of Leo X, with much less ability than Leo X. Leo X was his cousin. And with much less ability than Leo X, much less of general things that would appeal to people in general, he followed the same general policies. He was interested in the welfare of his family, the Medici family. He got his young niece married to the future King of France. He tried to advance the power of the papacy, and whenever he could do something against Lutheranism without interfering with his other activities, he would do it. But he did not really have much different attitude than Leo X. In 1534, Paul III, who became Pope, had a different attitude. And we'll continue there next Tuesday.